Chapter 65. Farat, Syria. Surrounding the town's most famous well was a small paved square. Ringing the square were street vendors and all sorts of small shops. Harvath, in the back seat of the pickup truck, took it all in from beneath his burqa. Yusuf was driving. Kabani sat in the passenger seat next to him. The Hadids had already been dropped off. "Have you seen enough?" Yusuf asked, his eyes on the road in front of him. He was very uncomfortable driving through the center of town.
"Keep going," Harvath replied. "I'll let you know."
Yusuf did as he was told and continued forward. According to the CIA, the town contained around 10,000 people. The few ISIS members he saw tried to blend in with the locals, but they were easy to spot. Outgathering intelligence, supplies, or simply functioning as lookouts, they had a ravaged, battle-hardened look about them. Their faces were stern and their eyes took in everything. None of them wore fatigues. They were dressed in civilian clothes. Traditional headdresses known as keffiyehs hung loosely around their necks. All of them had facial hair. The biggest giveaway, though, was their weight. While the townspeople were sickly thin, the young ISIS members were healthy and fit. None of them appeared to have missed any meals. To be posted to this town meant you were plugged into the elite of ISIS, and, as in any totalitarian system, there were two classes, those at the top and everyone else. The leaders of ISIS and their inner circle of fighters lived very well. They had their pick of houses, cars, and female hostages to serve as concubines. The rest of the organization, though, was suffering badly. Because of the ongoing international efforts against it, their rank and file, aka cannon fodder, had seen their wages cut in half, their rations reduced, and their medical care dry up. But their faith kept them marching forward into battle. Online, slick social media campaigns kept the fighters rolling in and helped to recruit followers around the globe, willing to carry out attacks in their own countries. No matter how bad things got, ISIS seemed only to grow in number and influence.
"Do you want to drive by the house?" Yusuf asked, as they left the square and headed north.
Harvath had a bag in his lap. Inside was his phone. He could see what the drone overhead was seeing. His earpiece allowed him to communicate back home to Langley.
"Not just yet," he replied. "Let's drive past the main mosque and then check the route out of town."
Yusuf shook his head. He thought Harvath way too brazen. But Harvath had made him the same promise he had made Kabani. He was going to take care of them and their families. It was an opportunity Yusuf never could have imagined. If the American remained true to his word, which Yusuf prayed to Allah he would, every risk he was being asked to take would be worth it. Harvath had chosen this route so that they passed the tiny storefront that functioned as the local police department. With ISIS in town, the police would have been bought off. He wanted to assess their level of professionalism. He noted two officers seated outside, smoking. They were unkempt. Their uniforms were wrinkled and one had a large stain. These were not law enforcement officers who took pride in themselves, much less their chosen profession. They wouldn't pose a problem. The problem would come from the ISIS members themselves. As they neared the mosque, Yusuf almost hit one of them. The man had stepped out from a parked vehicle to stop traffic. Several of his colleagues wanted to cross the street to attend early evening prayers. Yusuf didn't see him and slammed on the brakes at the very last second. He came so close that the man slammed his hand down on the hood of the pickup.
"Oh, shit,"
was the first thing that went through Harvath's mind, as the man raged at Yusuf in Arabic. To his credit, the Syrian kept his cool, apologized, and begged for forgiveness, his eyes cast down. The ISIS man, though, was spoiling for a fight. Grabbing the driver's side door, he yanked it open. Harvath had already put his phone in an interior pocket, dropped the bag to the floor, and had his hands under his burqa where he was cradling an AK in his lap. He had multiple extra magazines strapped to his chest, the Palafox Sig Sauer tucked in his sticky holster at the small of his back, and all the extra grenades that hadn't been used at the salt box. If these guys wanted to rock and roll, he was going to give them the best damn gunfight they'd ever seen. Maintaining his calm, he met Yusuf's eyes in the rearview mirror. The man was panic-stricken. Harvath nodded slowly, trying to reassure him. The ISIS fighter yelled for Yusuf to get out of the vehicle. Yusuf put it in park and did as he was told. Two of the ISIS fighters crossing the street came over to see what was going on. Harvath assessed each one, deciding who he was going to shoot first. This was turning into a goat rodeo real fast. Sizing up the combatants, he had decided to first shoot the guy hassling Yusuf when he heard the front passenger door opening. Kabani had decided to get out and intervene. Harvath couldn't believe it. Yusuf knew how to handle these sorts of things. Harvath had seen him in action multiple times. Kabani should have stayed in the truck. He was going to get himself and everybody else killed. No sooner had he stepped out of the pickup than the lead ISIS fighter started yelling at him to get back in. Harvath could see Kabani break the beams of the headlights as he crossed in front of the vehicle. The ISIS people didn't like his insolence. The lead fighter grabbed the front of Yusuf's shirt and snapped at one of his buddies to intercept Kabani. No sooner had the man begun to move than Harvath saw Kabani reach beneath his robe. Oh shit, Harvath thought again. Don't let it be a gun. Apparently, the ISIS members were all on the same wavelength, because immediately the guns that they had kept out of public view came flying out and were trained on Kabani. Harvath was now in a no-win situation. The minute he started shooting, either Yusuf or Kabani were going to die. He could only save one of them. Another person might have thought to save Kabani. With his cancer, Yusuf was already dead. But that wasn't how Harvath operated. He and Yusuf went back all of maybe 36 hours, but they'd been in the shit together. First and foremost, Harvath was loyal. If he had to choose whom to save, he was choosing Yusuf. It would be all for nothing, though, if fucking Kabani didn't stop right where he was. If he kept walking closer to Yusuf, there wasn't going to be a thing Harvath could do for either of them. Thankfully, one of the ISIS men punched him in the chest with the nubby barrel of a Scorpion machine pistol and halted his advance. Wrenching the crooked farmer's arm from beneath his robe, the ISIS man pulled it up to the light of the driver's side headlamp and showed what he had been reaching for. A bag of dates. Harvath couldn't believe it. The man had almost gotten everybody killed over a bag of fucking dates. The ISIS men seemed to appreciate the irony as well as they began laughing. The man with Kabani snatched the bag and shoved him back in the direction he had come from. The man standing with Yusuf slapped him in the face, laughed, and pushed him back in the truck. Arguing over the bag of dates, the three ISIS men crossed the street toward the mosque. Yusuf sat down and pulled his door shut. Harvath didn't dare say a word. He watched the Syrian grip the steering wheel until his knuckles turned white. He was enraged and channeling every ounce of it out and through the frame of the car. Once Kabani had climbed back in and closed the door, Yusuf put the vehicle in gear. He made sure no one else was attempting to cross the narrow street to get to the mosque and then lifted off the clutch and rolled forward. As soon as they started moving, Harvath asked, "Are you okay?" It was a stupid question, and he knew it, but he had to ask it anyway. Yusuf had been forced to swallow his pride on so many occasions that he no longer choked on it for long. "I'm fine," he replied. "Let's get this over with." Chapter 66. The white Toyota Hilux rolled forward, its occupants preparing to do a drive-by of the dwelling the American in the back seat had identified on his map. They were almost to the edge of town when Harvath said, "Stop."
I can't stop, Yusuf answered. We might attract attention.
Do it, Harvath ordered. Pull over, get out, and open the hood. Pretend like something's wrong with the truck.
Yusuf did as he was asked.
There's a building at our 11 o'clock, Harvath said via his earpiece. 3 back from the corner. Do you see it?
Roger that, Norseman, Lydia Ryan replied, watching the feed from the drone overhead. We see it. What's up?
Somebody has a ton of screens lit up in there.
Screens?
Monitors of some sort. I can't completely see from here.
Can you get a closer look? She asked.
Not without getting out of the vehicle.
What else do you see? Harvath scanned the vicinity for anything that appeared unusual or out of the ordinary.
Generators, he said finally. 4 of them.
4? Ryan responded.
Why the hell do they need that many?
He turned his head subtly toward the window and tried to peer through the mesh of the burqa.
I'm guessing that whatever those monitors are, they're drawing a lot of power. Plus, I can see air conditioning units.
Stand by, Norseman, she said. Harvath waited. A minute later, Ryan came back online.
We're very interested in what's going on inside that building. Picking up lots of activity.
Electronic? Harvath asked.
Roger that. Can you get a closer look?
He was just about to respond when Yusuf closed the hood and climbed back into the truck.
We need to go.
What's up?
We're being watched, the Syrian said, as he started the truck, revved it like he was having trouble, and then slowly put it in gear and began moving.
As soon as we stopped, a man appeared at the front of the building with a rifle and got on his cell phone.
From where Harvath had been sitting, he hadn't been able to see him.
Good eyes.
Replying to Langley, he said,
Negative on that closer look. Going to do a pass of the objective now.
Roger that, Ryan replied. Be careful. As they moved up the street, Harvath glanced sideways, taking in everything he could about the building with the AC and the extra generators. Someone had spent some serious money on it. Nearing Basayev's home on the edge of town, Harvath had the truck slow, but not much. The drone had already provided them some exceptional footage. He was just getting a feel for the area at this point. Who was parked where? What windows were open? Did any neighbors look too interested in what was happening outside on the street? They were the most basic of things he needed to know before Yusuf coasted to a stop 90 seconds later and dropped him off.
Do you have everything? Yusuf asked.
Harvath nodded.
Just stick to the plan. It's going to get very crazy, very quickly. Do what I told you, and everything will be fine.
Here,
Kabani said, as Harvath was about to close his door. He had brought an extra bag of dates and handed them to him.
Shukran,
Harvath replied in Arabic. Thank you. Gently closing the door, he watched as Yusuf drove off into the darkness and disappeared. If he didn't make it back, they were going to be in a lot of trouble. Insha'Allah, he thought, that wasn't going to happen. He had left the burqa in the vehicle and was dressed like the ISIS operatives in town, in jeans, a t-shirt, and a jacket. His keffiyeh, though, was wrapped so that it covered his face. He found the Hadids right where they were supposed to be.
Any movement? He asked.
Maitan pointed up toward the second floor of Sasha Basayev's house. There was a small balcony and its shutters were wide open.
Did you see him?
Toman nodded.
He stepped outside for a moment, and then stepped back inside.
Harvath hailed Ryan.
Second floor, northwest corner balcony. Shutters are open. Can you get a peek inside?
Stand by, she replied.
As they waited, Harvath glanced at his kobold chronograph. It glowed with a green luminescence. He tried to think what he would be doing right now if he were Basayev. What would he be doing if he had just gotten back from a series of operations overseas? No sooner had he asked the question than Ryan's voice crackled over his earpiece.
He's sleeping.
Say again,
Harvath replied.
He's sleeping, or at least that's what we think he's doing. Someone is stretched out horizontal on a bed in that room,
and they are most definitely alive and breathing.
Harvath nodded. That was exactly what he'd be doing. He would have dozed lightly on planes, not giving himself completely over to sound sleep until he was someplace where he felt safe. Then he would collapse. He would have a gun at hand and probably a knife or two, but as soon as he was back to someplace he considered home, he would have stepped off the edge into the deep black abyss of complete and total sleep, until his alarm went off. Then, Basayev would have to beat back his exhaustion, pry himself out of bed, and join his ISIS comrades for their celebration.
"Anyone else inside?" Harvath asked.
"Affirmative. Two additional tangos. One in the courtyard, appears to be seated, and we're getting a sketchy thermal from the first floor. Looks like just one person, but they're working hard to stay away from the windows."
"Roger that,"
Harvath replied.
"Two bodyguards?"
Eitan asked, once Harvath had signed off with Langley.
"Bodyguards or babysitters. I don't know, and I don't care. I just want Basayev," he stated. "Are you ready?"
Both of the Hadids nodded.
"Let's do it."
Chapter 67. Harvath was the first one over the wall. It wrapped around the entire house. Cars were meant to be parked in front, and there was a lush garden in back. ISIS obviously thought very highly of Sasha Basayev and had gifted him a very nice Syrian property. They were about to regret that, and then some. Harvath figured the two ISIS minders at the house had probably met Basayev at the airfield, had driven him back, and were now keeping an eye on him for whatever reason. Based on Basayev's skill set, he didn't strike him as someone who needed protection. Not that ISIS would have been familiar with his background, but by this point, he would have proved himself exceptionally capable in battle. Bodyguards seemed a bit over the top. That said, protection work was a plum assignment. Perhaps the goons watching over him were affiliated with the higher-ups in ISIS. He was probably doing someone a favor by taking them on. That was usually how these things went. Harvath didn't care. He was going to kill them both. Moving around to the front of the house, he adjusted his thermal goggles, the same pair he had worn at the salt box. By now, the Hadids would be up and over the wall, taking up their predetermined positions. Harvath had been very specific about what he wanted them to do, and, more important, not to do. Peering into the front courtyard, he saw the man guarding the closed front gates. Beyond him was a large Toyota Land Cruiser. The guard was leaned back in a chair, his feet up on a box of some sort. His weapon sat next to him, propped up against the wall. Staring through the goggles, he focused on the man's torso. It rose and fell in deep, slow breaths. Was this guy asleep too? Slung over his shoulder, Harvath had a small canvas bag with 2 1.5-liter water bottles. Removing one, he unscrewed the cap, pulled his cig, and placed the barrel into the mouth of the bottle, the poor man's suppressor. It would somewhat muffle his first shot, but it would limit his range and accuracy. He'd have to be up close, and after that, he only had one more bottle. Quietly, he crept forward. When he was about 15 feet away, he stopped. He could hear something. The man was snoring. He was definitely asleep. Holstering his weapon, he screwed the cap back on the bottle and slid it back into his bag. Then he drew his Winkler knife. As it came out of its leather sheath, he knew that the edge was being stropped one last time. Not that it needed it. It was already sharp enough. Careful of how and where he placed his feet, Harvath moved across the courtyard. When he had closed the distance with the ISIS man covering Basayev's front gate, he noticed how enormous he was. The guard couldn't have been an Arab. Harvath had never seen one that big. A couple of feet more, and Harvath was able to see his bearded face. The man was in his late 20s and looked Caucasian, possibly a Chechen. Harvath didn't waste any time. Slipping behind him, he placed his left palm across the man's mouth and tilted his head back as he plunged the knife into the base of his neck on the right side. Then, with a flick of his wrist, he shot the knife forward. It slashed his trachea and severed his artery. Even though he was unable to call out for help, the man still fought hard as the blood gushed from his throat. He was so big, it took all of the strength that Harvath had to keep him seated in his chair. When the last bit of life had finally fled the man's body, Harvath released his grasp. Wiping his blade on the man's coat, Harvath returned it to its sheath and approached the house. Based on the drone intel, the man on the ground floor was going to be difficult to subdue. Removing the bottle of water again, he made ready to step inside. Stepping up to the front of the building, he looked left and then right. The Hadids were in place, and both of them indicated that he was clear to go through the front door. Harvath tried the handle. It was unlocked. Gently, he pushed it open and peered inside. Thermal goggles read heat, which allowed him to not only pick up people, but also the heat left behind in handprints as well as footprints. Following Muslim tradition, the men had taken off their boots and left them near the front door. While Basayev's heat signature had already faded, Harvath could make out the footprints of the man the drone had picked up moving around on the ground floor. He had just exited a nearby room and walked toward the back of the home. Harvath wasn't sure if it was to the kitchen or some other room. A faint light glowed at the end of the hall. Careful not to make any noise, he slipped inside and closed the front door behind him. Flipping up his goggles, he gave his eyes a chance to adjust to the light. Though he couldn't see the man, he could hear him. There was the muted sound of gunfire and then an explosion. Harvath instantly knew what was going on. The ISIS operative was playing a video game, probably a first-person shooter simulation. Younger jihadists love games like Halo and Call of Duty. They binged on them, whiling away hours of boredom, believing the games helped improve their battlefield performance. Though that part was dubious, one thing was for sure. The act of immersing yourself in a video absolutely shredded your situational awareness. The ISIS operative had no clue that Harvath had entered the room and was standing right behind him. His rifle lay on the couch next to him, but both of his hands were on his game controller. He wasn't as big as the man outside, but he was still quite large and about the same age. Harvath raised his weapon. When the man let loose with a noisy full auto burst of gunfire in the game, Harvath pressed the trigger of his Sig Sauer. The round exploded through the water bottle and tore through the man's head. Blood, bone, and pieces of brain matter splattered across the console, the screen, and the wall just beyond it. The back of the couch was soaked with water. Two down, one to go, thought Harvath. Backing out of the room, he made his way through the house, checking each room as he went. The furnishings were cheap and threadbare, but one item caught his eye. In the kitchen, among the dented pots and decades-old pans, was a gorgeous, very expensive Japanese chef's knife. It was displayed like a museum piece, just as the knives in Basayev's apartment in Frankfurt had been. Evil always wanted to possess what it could not create. Leaving the kitchen, Harvath arrived at the darkened staircase leading up to the second story. Coming to a stop, he stood for several moments and listened. There was no sound. So, with the Hadid standing guard outside, he flipped his goggles down and began his ascent. He chose his steps carefully, making sure to stay to the outside of each tread. The stairs were solid, not one groaned under the weight of his boots. At the top of the landing, he stopped, looked left, and then he looked right. All of the doors were open except for one, Basayev's. He listened again, but still heard nothing. He had no idea if the man was awake or asleep. Holstering his pistol, he removed the black Taser X26P Williams had provided him with in Amman and powered it up. The floors of the hallway were covered with stone. He wouldn't have to worry about a board creaking and giving him away. Even so, he chose his steps just as carefully as he had coming up the stairs. Bisaya was so close, he could almost feel him. But no sooner had he neared the bedroom door than he realized he was in trouble. It didn't have a handle. For security, Basayev had rigged it so that it could only be opened from the inside.
Fuck, Harvath cursed under his breath.
He examined the door itself and then the frame, looking for a latch or a switch, anything that might open it from this side. He came up empty.
Think, he told himself. There has to be a way. There's always a way.
Then he remembered the balcony and the shutters that were open to the outside. Retreating from the door, he retraced his footsteps to the top of the stairs and began searching for the roof access. It had to be somewhere on the second floor. Moving quietly through each room, he searched, looking for a panel in the ceiling, a ladder, or some sort of hidden staircase. As he did, he tried to recall the images he had seen of the roof. How was it accessed? Finally, he realized the access had to be from Basayev's room. In fact, it probably was a trap door of some sort that he had covered up with one of the upturned satellite dishes. That meant Harvath was going to have to find another way up. He stuck his head out the windows of two rooms before he finally found a part of the facade with enough handholds to get him all the way up to the roof. Securing all of his gear, he stepped out onto a narrow ledge and began to climb. It took only a couple of seconds to get up and over the top.
What are you doing on the roof? Ryan asked from back at Langley.
Harvath looked up, though he knew he wouldn't be able to see the drone.
Long story. Is Pitchfork still in bed?
Roger that, she replied. The Reaper just made a pass. He's still there.
At least something was going his way.
Roger that, Harvath whispered. Going to Zero Comms.
Zero Comms was code for no further communications. He didn't need people talking in his ear as he was preparing to take down Basayev.
Zero comms. Roger that, Ryan said. Good luck.
Harvath appreciated it. With what he was about to do, he was going to need all the luck in the world. Chapter 68. Climbing up onto the roof was one thing. Climbing down was something altogether different. Harvath was forced to leave most of his gear behind. In addition to weighing him down, it rattled and made too much noise. He couldn't afford to make a sound. Slipping over the edge of the roof, he began his descent toward Basayev's balcony. It was much more difficult here than the other side of the house had been, far fewer handholds and places to put his feet. The grips were so minimal that there were places where he was digging his fingernails into soft pieces of mortar just to hang on. He moved not by inches, but by millimeters. His hands ached and his body was soon covered with perspiration. If anyone happened by below, he'd be exposed. Shoving the pain and the pounding of his heart from his consciousness, he kept going. The balcony was only a few more meters away. He kept running out of places to put his hands as well as his feet, but each time he did, he took a breath and willed himself to look around.
Find something, he told himself. It's here. You just have to look for it.
And each time he did, he found it. The balcony now was only feet away. It was almost over. He kept moving toward it, ready to let go of the wall. But no sooner had he reached it than he heard a sound from inside. Basayev had set an alarm on his phone to wake himself up. Harvath couldn't even manage to utter the word fuck. The pain in his hands was excruciating, and it was spreading. He could feel it in his legs, his arms, and his back. His entire body wanted him to give up. It was begging him to. Each nerve ending was screaming for him to let go and just drop to the ground. The fact that he'd be badly injured in the fall made no difference. All the muscles of his body could focus on was immediate relief. Let go, they screamed. Let go. Harvath bit down and redoubled his tenuous grip on the wall. He wasn't going to let go. He forced himself to keep moving toward the balcony. But what about Basayev? He strained his ears for any hint of what was going on inside. The alarm had been silenced. Did that mean he was awake, or had he activated the snooze feature and rolled over and gone back to sleep? He was too close to even whisper back to Ryan to give him a sit rep from the drone. And unless the drone was making a pass right at that moment, it wouldn't be able to provide him the feedback he needed. There was only one way to know for sure. Pushing himself the last foot and a half, he reached the balcony and eased himself down onto its solid concrete wraparound. Relief immediately coursed through his body. He didn't have time, though, to stand there and allow his body to uncramp. He needed to move. Stepping quietly off the surround and onto the balcony floor, he willed his stiff fingers to obey and drew his taser. This was it. Basayev was about to pay for everything that he had done. Moving toward the large shutters that separated the balcony from the bedroom, he paused. There was no sound. Harvath took that as a good sign. The exhausted man had rolled over and gone back to sleep. With his taser tucked into the ready position at his chest, he spun into Basayev's room and prepared to fire. The bed, though, was empty. In the corner was an AK-47, but no Basayev. Harvath barely had any time to process what was happening before his target was on top of him. Basayev must have awoken and heard a sound from the balcony. With no time to get his weapon, he must have simply pressed himself up against the wall to wait for his attacker to materialize. When he did, Basayev sprang, leveraging the element of surprise for all it was worth. He landed two devastating blows, one under the man's jaw and one to the side of his head. Harvath saw stars immediately, and his already fatigued legs went rubbery on him. Basayev didn't give him a moment or a millimeter to collect himself. He rained the blows down like a gorilla swinging a pair of sledgehammers. It was pure sistema, the lethal Russian martial art taught to the Spetsnaz and all of the nation's intelligence operatives. The elbow and knee strikes came again and again and again. Harvath's vision dimmed and he lost control of the taser. He barely heard it fall and go clattering across the floor. The blows came so hard and so fast, Harvath couldn't get himself into a position long enough to reach for his pistol or his knife. He was getting his ass kicked. There was no other way to phrase it. Basayev was an amazingly well-trained and brutal fighter, relentless in his attack. If Harvath didn't do something fast, he was going to lose consciousness. And if he did, it would be game over for him. There was only one thing he could think to do. Planting his feet, he dropped into a squat and lunged at Basayev, catching him around the waist and driving him over backward. They landed hard on the concrete floor and the air raced from Basayev's lungs. Harvath showed him no mercy. Harvath beat him twice as hard as Basayev had beaten him. He beat Basayev for every American he had killed. He beat him for every loved one and family member who had been left behind. He broke ribs and watched Basayev vomit up blood. He grazed him with a punch across the top of his head so severe it removed a piece of scalp. And then, on the razor-thin edge of killing the man, he stopped and rolled off him. Basayev gasped, trying to fill his body again with oxygen. He coughed repeatedly, aspirating on his own blood. A river of it ran from his torn lip. Some even ran out of his left ear. Harvath had been opened up in a couple of places across his face, but he looked like a supermodel in comparison. Struggling to his feet, he retrieved his taser and then came back over and kicked Basayev as hard as he could in the ribs. The blow hit so hard, he could actually hear them crack.
"That's from the President of the United States."
He was tempted to deliver another kick, but he didn't want to risk puncturing and collapsing one of the man's lungs. There were still several things he needed from him. Rolling Basayev over onto his stomach, Harvath zip-tied his wrists and ankles, placed a piece of duct tape across his mouth, and then forced him to sit upright against the wall. Harvath felt like he had been hit by a train. Sliding down the wall into a sitting position next to him, Harvath caught his breath and waited for some of his strength to return.
It took everything he had not to kill Basayev right there and right then. As far as DC was concerned, that was a perfectly legitimate option. Harvath, though, wanted more. Pulling out his phone, he got ready to interrogate him. But before he removed the tape from the man's mouth, he explained what his options were. He was offering him a one-time-only deal. If Basayev agreed, Harvath would honor his end of the bargain. If he didn't, Harvath would leave him for ISIS and would make sure they knew he was a traitor.
"So, what's it going to be, Sasha?" he asked, as he yanked the piece of tape off his mouth.
The man turned to the side and spat a glob of blood and saliva onto the floor. Turning his gaze back to Harvath, he replied,
"I accept."
Chapter 69. Harvath's original plan had been to get to Basayev, interrogate Basayev, and identify the location of the meeting honoring Basayev. From there, he would call in a drone strike. Then he and Nicholas would embellish. Nicholas would rework the drone footage to make it look like the Russians had carried out the strike. He would get it out to anti-Russian jihadist websites, forums, and chat rooms. The Islamists in all the places Russia was worried about would go berserk. For his part, as ISIS fighters rushed to the scene of the attack to look for survivors and help dig people out of the rubble, Harvath would lie in wait with the sniper rifle. He would pick off as many as possible and then flee. Near the edge of town, the Hadids would have staged an accident. Basayev would be trapped, unconscious, in a rolled-over vehicle. Harvath would plant the rifle as well as a few other pieces of incriminating Russian evidence, and they'd all be off. When ISIS found Basayev, they would tear him limb from limb. Harvath was a sucker for happy endings. But, as things often did in the field, something changed. Basayev revealed a piece of bombshell information. Inside the house glowing with monitors, the one with all the extra generators and air conditioning, was the social media mastermind for ISIS, the creative force behind not only their internet recruiting, but all of their propaganda, including their horrific videos. There was one additional factor that made him special in Harvath's eyes. He was the HVT Saleh had identified. Because of him, the CIA SAD team and their pilots had been killed in Anbar. Because of him, three American women from the U.S. Embassy in Amman had been brutally raped and killed. And because of him, Harvath was willing to take a huge risk. The man was too valuable a target to pass up. At this point, the only question normally on Harvath's mind was, kill or capture? But while killing had always provided a certain satisfaction, it no longer felt like it was enough. Not after so many lives had already been lost. He wanted more than blood. He wanted substantive revenge against both ISIS and the Russians. That meant the social media mastermind and Basayev were actually worth more to him alive. And so, he had made up his mind.
"Wait, you're asking permission to do what exactly?" Ryan replied from Langley.
"I'm not asking permission," Harvath clarified. "Now, can you get it done or not?"
She knew better than to argue with him. His ability to adapt under high-stress situations and prevail was why they had hired him. He was his own man, especially when he was in the field. With or without them, he was going to do it. His mind was made up. After a quick discussion with the Pentagon, she came back online.
"DOD has a Reaper in western Iraq. It'll take them at least 45 minutes, though, until they can get it on station over you."
"What's it carrying?"
4 Hellfires, plus 2 500-pound GBU-38s.
JDAMs. Harvath knew the munition well. It was a bolt-on guidance package that turned dumb, unguided gravity bombs into smart, precision-guided game-changers. The DOD drone represented a massive amount of ordnance. Harvath liked that. He was a big fan of overkill. If a little was good, then a ton was even better. And it sent a hell of a message.
The meeting starts in half an hour, he replied. Tell them to step on it.
As Ryan signed off, Harvath's mind turned to how they were going to pull off snatching the social media guru. According to Basayev, there were two guards inside the house, one on the first floor and another up on the second, as Yusuf had seen. The house also contained three racks of servers. If Harvath could grab their hard drives, in addition to the media mastermind, it would be a huge coup for the U.S. Everyone in the house, though, had explicit instructions to destroy everything if they came under attack. That left Harvath with a serious problem. The downstairs had been converted into an open area where the social media people worked. Besides the guru, there were six key players, two video editors, plus four operatives who monitored all the ISIS social media channels and fed ISIS propaganda to a series of sympathizers around the globe who acted as repeater stations. The servers were kept in a locked room upstairs, and Basayev gave Harvath a complete rundown of how the home was laid out. If it was all accurate, and considering that Basayev's life hung in the balance, and he had no reason to believe it wasn't, Harvath had the advantage. He would have the element of surprise. What he didn't have, though, was a plan. He had beaten Basayev so badly, the man couldn't be used as a ruse to get him inside. And while there were only two guards, the rest of the social media people, though admittedly geeks to greater or lesser degrees, all had AK-47s. They carried them to look tough, but none of them were killers. Even so, all it took was one lucky shot. An armed combatant was an armed combatant. Geeks or not, they were committed jihadists, and Harvath wasn't going to show any of them an ounce of mercy. The only person he cared about in that house was their head of social media. Basayev said his name was Rafael, a 27-year-old British national of Pakistani descent. He was short and fat with a scraggly beard, greasy hair, and glasses. And while he professed to hate the West for its decadence, he could always be found wearing a vintage Western rock band t-shirt such as The Clash or Elvis Costello. He was also known for living on huge amounts of strawberry licorice and tall cans of sugary energy drinks. Reflecting on the details, Harvath thought, who the fuck lives on strawberry licorice and energy drinks in the middle of a war zone? Then, like a bolt from the blue, a brilliant and elegantly simple plan crystallized in his mind. Chapter 70. Harvath and Matan left 20 minutes before everyone else. With the help of the CIA's Reaper, they had pinpointed the perfect spot. The half-finished building had never been occupied. From the roof, it provided a perfect view of the street in front of Raphael's house. They filled the pillowcase from Basayev's with sand, and once Harvath was all set up, Matan melted away into the neighborhood to conduct a final round of reconnaissance. Using the Reaper's onboard equipment, Ryan confirmed back in Langley both shots Harvath would be taking. Based on how the rifle had performed out in the dunes, he adjusted for a little Kentucky windage and settled in. He was lying on an old pallet that had been left up on the roof and was using a pillowcase as a rest for the rifle. He'd already urinated twice, once before leaving Basayev's and again when arriving at the building. He had slugged back almost an entire bottle of water and wouldn't be able to move until his job was done. Ryan continued to feed him a play-by-play from Langley of what they were seeing from the drone.
Pitchfork is rolling, she said. Repeat. Pitchfork is rolling.
That meant Basayev's Land Cruiser was on the move. Toman would be at the wheel, Basayev in the captain's chair behind him, and Kabani and Yusuf in the third row. Toman was the most important. Harvath was counting on him to both mind Basayev and to be immediately ready to go hot if things went kinetic. It was a tall order, but he had no doubt he was up to it. Peering through his night scope, Harvath settled in behind the weapon and got ready to take his shots.
Inbound, Ryan relayed. Pitchfork, 90 seconds. Make ready.
Harvath studied the leaves on the trees down on the street. There was a slight hint of a breeze. He adjusted his scope accordingly.
"Pitchfork, 60 seconds to target,"
came Ryan's voice from Northern Virginia.
"Players are cleared hot. Repeat, players are cleared hot."
That was a good sign. It meant that Langley wasn't seeing any non-combatants nearby. They were free to engage anyone inside the house. A sudden burst of air moved through. Harvath went to adjust his rifle, but the leaves settled down. Slowing his heart rate, he took long, deep breaths and placed the pad of his finger on the PSL's trigger.
"Pitchfork, 30 seconds to target. Repeat, 30 seconds to target."
Harvath waited for the next update from CIA headquarters. It came seconds later.
"Pitchfork cellular engaged."
Focusing on the upper window across the street, he got ready to take his shot. Ryan read the text messages as they moved back and forth between Basayev's and Raphael's phones.
"Strawberry licorice?"
"And monster."
"You are awesome!"
"Got them in duty-free on my way back."
"I owe you.
When can I pick them up?"
"On way to meeting, near your house. Can drop them now."
"Seriously?"
"Seriously."
"You rock!"
"See you soon."
"Okay."
Ryan then said,
"All players, 15 seconds. Pitchfork on target. Repeat, pitchfork on target, 15 seconds.
Harvath watched the upstairs window and began to apply pressure to his trigger. The biggest rule in a gunfight was that if you weren't shooting, you'd better be moving or reloading. But in his case, as soon as he got his shots off, he was going to have to haul ass. They were beyond shorthanded. The only reason he was on the roof was because neither of the Hadids was even halfway decent with a long gun. Once he took his shots, he'd have to move fast.
"Look sharp, Norseman," Ryan then said. "Pitchfork on target in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Opening his other eye, Harvath watched as Basayev's Land Cruiser rolled to a stop on the street below. Three strips of duct tape on the roof formed a large N so that the vehicle could be identified from above. The same had been done to the roof of Yusuf's pickup.
"Am outside,"
Ryan said, relaying Basayev's text message to Raphael. Harvath watched as a figure appeared moments later at the upper window.
"Tango, second story," he said.
"Coming out,"
Ryan said, as the ground floor door opened.
"On your mark, Norseman."
"Roger that,"
Harvath replied.
"Stand by."
Adjusting his rifle, he focused on the door and watched as Raphael emerged. Harvath recognized him both by his physical appearance and by his t-shirt, featuring one of Harvath's favorite funk musicians, George Clinton. Leading the way was the ground floor security operative, who walked about 2 feet in front of him toward Basayev's SUV.
"Boardwalk,"
Toman said from the driver's seat of the Land Cruiser. He was using Harvath's code word to signal that the two men had cleared the building and Harvath could fire when ready.
"Roger that,"
Harvath replied, refocusing on the figure in the upper window.
"Boardwalk,"
he repeated, pressing his trigger. No sooner had the round left the barrel of his weapon than he refocused on the guard on the ground and fired again. When the ground floor guards had evaporated in a sea of pink mist, Harvath ordered,
"Go, go, go!"
Toman had already partially opened the Land Cruiser's door. Upon hearing the command, he leapt out, raised Harvath's taser, and fired at Raphael. Simultaneously, Maitan kicked in the back door of the house, charged inside, and fired his AK above the heads of the social media jihadists. While all this was happening, Harvath had abandoned his rifle, picked up his AK, and was racing down the stairs of the abandoned building. Taking them three at a time, he yelled over his earpiece to Toman,
"Get inside now! Move, move, move!"
The second row passenger side captain's chair had been removed, so that as Toman tasered Raphael, Yusuf could leap out, run around the back of the SUV, and restrain him. The cancer-stricken Syrian wasn't the fastest man any of them had ever seen, but he was diligent. As Toman dropped the taser and ran for the house, Yusuf landed on Raphael, drove his knee into his back, and pulled out the roll of duct tape he had been given for restraining him. Harvath caught it out of the corner of his eye as he tore across the street. He watched as Yusuf, who was no fan of ISIS, landed a series of vicious body blows on the fat social media operative. In any other situation, he would have stopped to cheer him on, but there was something much more important happening. When Harvath hit the door, both Hadids were already inside.
"Talk to me," he yelled.
Several rounds of automatic weapons fire answered back, and Harvath immediately took cover behind one of the house's columns. 2 minutes later, Toman yelled out,
"Clear!"
"Maitan!"
Harvath shouted.
"Clear!"
the other Hadid brother yelled. Slowly, Harvath peered around the column and into the large open room. It was a sea of blood, punctuated by islands of dead bodies. The Hadids had killed them all, and in their defense, Harvath couldn't see a single jihadist who didn't look as if he had been reaching for his weapon. Toman and Maitan had done the right thing.
"Let's go,"
he ordered, pointing toward the second floor. Leading the charge, Harvath raced up the stairs, stopping only long enough to check the hallway before sweeping into the room where he had shot the ISIS operative through the window. The man lay dead in a pool of blood. Harvath's round had entered just above his right eye, gone straight through his brain and out the back of his head. Catching up with the Hadids, he helped them pull the rest of the hard drives and then called down to Yusuf.
"Coming out. Get ready."
As they exited the house with three pillowcases filled with hard drives, Yusuf was waiting behind the wheel of the Land Cruiser. The three men leapt inside. Harvath checked to make sure Basayev and Raphael were present and then ordered,
"Go! Go! Go!"
They raced to where Maitan had left Yusuf's pickup and divided up. Once they were free of the town, Harvath hailed Ryan and said,
"We're clear. Light 'em up. Do it now. All of them."
Chapter 71. Off the Record Bar, Hay Adams Hotel, Washington, D.C. It had been a long day, and Rebecca Ritter needed a drink, a big one. After her nooner with Joe Edwards, she had slipped away to another clandestine rendezvous. This one was all talk and no action. In fact, Rebecca had been grilled for well over an hour. By the time she left, she had a splitting headache. Everyone seemed to feel she wasn't doing enough. Intuitively, she knew it was part of the carrot and stick play. No matter how well she performed, they were always going to want more. She was pushing the ultimate drug, power, and they were hooked. Stopping at a CVS on the way back to the office, she had purchased a bottle of Naprosyn and 2 cans of Red Bull. She was tempted to call in sick for the balance of the afternoon, but she couldn't risk making Senator Wells any angrier. He was still upset over the question she had planted for him at Meet the Press yesterday. It had taken him by surprise, which had been her intention, and he had handled it brilliantly. He had acted like a senior statesman, above the fray, and, while not giving details, he had assured the host and the American people that it was being looked into. It was perfect. They had gotten the rumor into the news cycle, but without making it look like it had come directly from Wells. All of the papers this morning had run with it. The senator acted upset for another day or two, but in his heart, he knew Rebecca had done him a huge favor. President Porter had just been taken down another peg in the minds of American voters. A couple more leaks between now and the election, and Porter wouldn't stand a chance. Returning to her office, she tackled a pile of paperwork on her desk and tried to winnow down her long list of phone calls and emails that needed to be returned. At 5 o'clock, she grabbed her purse and headed for the Hay Adams Hotel across from the White House. Its famous off-the-record bar was considered one of the hottest watering holes in D.C. It was known as the place to be seen, but not overheard. Located on the hotel's lower level, Its walls were covered with caricatures of the politically powerful, both past and present. Rebecca fully expected her own to be up there one day soon. The bar was already filling up by the time she got there. As she entered, she turned more than a few heads. Though she'd had a tough day, none of the men in the place seemed to notice, nor would they have cared. Rebecca Ritter was a stunning woman, no matter what the situation. Walking up to the bar, she grabbed the last stool at the end, waved the bartender over, and ordered a double maker's mark on the rocks. As the bartender poured her drink, she turned to survey the room. Even in the wake of the attack on the White House, it was still a Washington power spot. She was always on the lookout for well-connected people who could expand her sphere of influence. Her eyes came to rest on a tall, distinguished-looking man who had just approached the bar to order his own drink.
"You're Brian Wilson," she said. "Mornings on the Mall on WMAL.
"I am indeed," the broadcaster replied with a smile, flattered to be recognized by such an attractive young woman.
"Rebecca Ritter, Chief of Staff for Senator Wells."
As she spoke, she extended her hand. Wilson took it politely and, sharp man that he was, noticed that she arched her back in order to subtly extend another part of her body. "The senator is making a lot of news lately. We'd love to have him on the show."
"Absolutely," Ritter replied, fishing out one of her business cards. "Do you have a pen?"
Wilson removed a pen from his blazer pocket and handed it to her. Writing on the back of the card, she said,
"This is my personal cell phone number."
The broadcaster didn't need to look left or right. He could feel the envious stares of all the men at the bar.
"You were fantastic at Fox, if memory serves. You also broke the story of Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's retirement."
"You have good taste and a good memory," Wilson said. "Although, I think you're a little too young to remember that."
"I make it my business to know things," she replied with a coy smile, as she picked up her drink and took a seductive sip through its straw. "I've always enjoyed your work. In fact, I think you'd make a terrific White House spokesperson."
Was she trying to pick him up or offer him a job? Whatever it was, Wilson was enjoying it. And whatever ended up happening, he was going to have one hell of a story to tell his co-host Larry O'Connor in the morning. "So," he said, turning the subject back to work, "when can we get Senator Wells on the show?" Rebecca was about to speak when one of the concierges from the hotel upstairs appeared. "Miss Ritter?" he asked.
"Yes." "You have a phone call at the front desk. It's your office."
"My office," she replied, removing her phone from her purse and looking at it. The signal strength appeared fine, and there were no missed calls or messages.
"Yes, ma'am. If you'll follow me."
"Will you excuse me for a moment?" she said to Wilson.
"Of course." Taking one more sip of her drink, she set it on the bar, gathered up her purse, and followed the concierge. Upstairs, he directed her to the phone that had been placed atop the concierge desk. A husband and wife, probably hotel guests, looking to make reservations for dinner or something, stood at the other end. As she approached the phone and picked up the line the concierge had indicated, the man and woman stepped over to her.
"Rebecca Ritter,"
the woman stated, displaying a set of credentials. "FBI.
"You're under arrest,"